4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in the new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with oceanographer Kevin Arrigo. Stay with us.
I am Lucas Oswald, and I'm here with Kevin Arrigo, a professor in Environmental Earth System Sciences here at Stanford University. And so, Kevin, could we start off by maybe giving us a brief summary of the research you do and its general aims and goals?
I guess the research that I do, you could sort of broadly characterize as it's climate change related, global nutrient cycling mostly, particularly carbon and nitrogen. And basically what we're interested in is how sort of the biology of the oceans affects climate and how climate in turn affects the biology of the oceans. And most of our work deals with high-latitude environments, mostly in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica and more recently in the Arctic.
Why did NASA want to get involved in this?
That's the question everybody asks. You know, NASA's a space agency. Why in the world are they funding cruises? NASA's in the business of putting satellites in space. And they've got a series of Earth-observing satellites that they put into space. And it's a real technological challenge to interpret what these satellites are telling us about the Earth.
Oh, so this has to do with the remote sensing work.
It does. Know. And so what it turns out, the Arctic is probably, not even probably, it is the most challenging place in the world to do remote sensing of the ocean. It's a very high latitude environment, which means lots of things. It's very cloudy, it's cold, lots of ice to deal with. But it's also very low sun angles when it comes to this, the sun, and that's not a good situation for satellite remote sensing. In addition to that, it's an environment where you've got all these big rivers surrounding the Arctic, dumping all this material in. And unfortunately, from space, a lot of the material that gets dumped into the ocean looks a lot like the things we're trying to see from space. Specifically, we're looking at concentrations of chlorophyll, which tells us how much biology is in the water.
So how much living organic matter.
That's right. And so, but it's difficult to distinguish this material that runs off from the oceans. It's actually colored like tea, really. In fact, it's the exact same stuff that tea is made out of. It dumps into the ocean, and it looks to a satellite like phytoplankton, like algae, and it isn't. And so one of the things that we were going to do, in fact, there were four optical groups sent on the ship with us to do this, is to make measurements there in the water and do comparisons between what the satellite is telling us is there and what we see is actually there.
Okay. So it's kind of calibrating.
It is. It's calibrating and also developing new and better algorithms. Because if we can do it in the Arctic, we can do it anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the challenge. There's that aspect of it. The other aspect of the program was more related to just the biology of global change, how it is that there's lots of changes going on in the Arctic that lots of people are probably pretty familiar with. We've had, you know, the ice caps are melting. We've lost lots of sea ice in the last couple decades for sure. It's accelerating. And one question is, how is that impacting the local biology of the Arctic? Mm-hmm. And so that was my interest in going up there and doing the studies we were doing. We were really interested in, to us, there's lots of melting sea ice. For me, it was, oh, this is great new habitat for phytoplankton to grow in. You don't have this cover of ice anymore. And we wanted to see what kind of changes that was going to bring about in the ecosystem. And so that's what my focus was on.
You're talking a lot about the research you do in the Arctic and in Antarctica. For those of us who haven't traveled there, we often don't have a good differentiation between the two regions.
Oh, yeah.
But What continues to draw you back to the Arctic, other than your research goals? Because you go there so often.
Well, it's a fascinating place to go. I go to the Antarctic and I go to the Arctic. They're similar in many ways and they're different in many ways. The Arctic is nice. We've been doing more work in the Arctic recently. It's a lot more accessible than the Antarctic is. It's just closer to where we live. It's generally easier to get to. Logistically, it's a little more difficult to do than the Antarctic, which is kind of surprising. But they're still, they're amazing places to go. And so just in terms of, the things you see and the things you experience when you're up there, it always draws you back. At least it does for me.
It seems like, I would imagine, the closer you get to the Arctic, the kind of less and less you see of, life around you and the more desolation you see around you. Is that part of the appeal for you?
In some sense, it takes a little getting used to. It's unusual because, by the time you're there, it's 24 hours of daylight. And so the conditions are really different. And almost everything you see is black or white or gray, other than the ship. The ship is red, but other than that, there's really not much color anywhere you look. The ocean is a little bit, it's not even very blue. It looks sort of gray by the time you're there when it's cloudy skies. There's not much to see. But, it's the wildlife was terrific. Mm-hmm. We went through, the first year we went, I didn't see a single whale. This last time we went, we just saw hundreds and hundreds of whales. And it was just absolutely amazing. And there's walruses and seals and stuff and lots of birds flying around. And so that's, that makes it interesting. And the weather is, you get nice sunny days where it's calm and you get stormy days where it's, tough to actually get your work done. So it's always something different. It's never dull. It's certainly never dull.
It sounds like without the support that you might get with going to Antarctica, like you're talking about, it might be a greater sense of adventure, like it's by your own volition that you're going there. Is that, what was the initial inspiration to travel there for you? Was that, had something to do with it?
In sciences, luck plays an important role. And I happened to be giving a talk at a national meeting on our findings for the Arctic. And it was at the same time that NASA's program manager in charge of biology and biogeochemistry had thought that she wanted to do some sort of Arctic expedition. And so she came, she saw my talk, and she asked me if, I'd be willing to sort of help provide background material for the kind of questions that, the scientific questions that they might want to look at if they did an Arctic program. And so, I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and that's how I got involved in the program. And so, I took charge of writing it's called a white paper, and providing guidance. I helped assemble the team, and I was chief scientist on the cruises. And so
that's pretty lucky in the middle of an effort to research the most difficult place in the planet.
Well, and
NASA
comes
behind you.
I tell my students all the time, I said, do not ever underestimate the importance of any talk you give at a meeting. This was literally a 12-minute talk at a scientific meeting. And out of this 12-minute talk came this, this big 4-year research proposal that just almost fell into my lap. And so, every talk is a potential, for something bigger coming along, and it sort of happened in my case for sure.
So for the average person, climate change is mostly unobservable. We don't really feel global warming directly. It seems like if it's observable anywhere, it must be in the Arctic. And you've mentioned how you saw some differences in the ice caps. What has been the most shocking change in the Arctic or Antarctica that you've observed in your work there?
Before this summer, I would have given a different answer, so I'm going to give both answers. Initially, the biggest shock was the rate of ice loss, particularly in the last, maybe since 2007 especially. It's been really accelerating, and that was really surprising. That took everybody's surprise. We've been on this 30-year downward trend for a while, but we've sort of been, even though we've been wobbling around that trend, it hasn't really accelerated greatly until 2007. In 2007, that's when we lost 23% of the summer ice.
Did that come as a big surprise to the scientific community?
People spent a long time. There's still lots of debate about what actually brought that about. And there's a variety of ideas of why, how could we have lost so much ice in just 1 year? And it led to some speculation in terms of, when we would see the day that there is no ice in the Arctic in the summer at all. Mm-hmm. Even today, there's still, even in the middle of summer, you've got relatively large amount of ice in the Arctic, but it's certainly getting less and less. And people had predicted that as early as 2013, there would be no summer ice left, which is not going to happen. That's not going to turn out to be true. It's probably going to be more like the middle of the century. But it's still a really big change.
It's still open to... I remember it was a big deal when it became open for transport during the summer. So it's not completely... It is, the ice is sparse enough that ships can go through it.
At certain times of year and certain years, yes. It's still not universally true.
Mm-hmm.
So like 2011 was another year. It was almost as bad in terms of ice loss as 2007 was this year.
Do you have an opinion in, because you said there were multiple ideas of why that might have happened. Do you have an opinion personally?
Well, I think, I mean, it's the science. And so the science suggests that it might be multiple causes. Initially, what has been happening, and this is sort of, I mean, it's one of the driving forces behind many of the changes in the Arctic, is that since probably in the 80s and up to the 90s, the atmospheric circulation in the Arctic has been such that lots of the old thick ice drifted out of the Arctic Ocean and into the North Atlantic, where it melted. And it used to be the Arctic ice cap was made up of ice that was five, six years old, that might have been, 15 feet thick or even more.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that old ice is gone now, and we're left with a lot of young, thin ice. And so what ends up happening is you lose the thick ice, the thin ice replaces it, it's a lot easier to melt the thin ice in the summertime, and so you end up getting less and less and less ice. And so I think it's called ice albedo feedback. And what that really basically means is that the more ice you melt, the more you can heat the ocean, which means the less ice you form the next year, which means the easier you can melt it the next year. And so you just get this, it just accelerates on itself.
So what does that mean for the potential of recovering the ice caps if the majority of the old ice, which you said is so important to the system, is now gone? And we only have this young ice that is a lot more fragile.
Really unlikely. Once you're on this feedback path, it's hard to get off it again. Once you start accelerating toward ice loss, it's really hard to back up and start making lots of new thick ice. It's not that it's not possible, but it's certainly not anything anybody's predicting. And there's certainly evidence that the waters in the Arctic Ocean are getting warmer. And if they're actually getting warmer, that just makes it that much harder to make new ice.
So you said... there were two things that you saw that were the most shocking. Was that the older one?
That was the older one. So what we found this... All right, my perspective comes from Antarctic work initially. So we've done a lot of work on the Antarctic. And the one rule you could always count on in the Antarctic is whenever there was ice there, the water under the ice was a biological desert. There was just nothing there. And the reason that is because things that live in the ocean, base of the food web, the phytoplankton, the algae, they need light. And there's when you've got 3 feet thick of ice and maybe 10, maybe a foot of snow on top of that, just no light gets to the ocean at all. And so nothing grows. Well, when we went to the Arctic, we assumed the same thing was going to be happening. We assumed whenever we got under the ice that it would be a biological desert. You typically work in open water, and if things get icy, you can deal with the ice. But oftentimes you don't intentionally go... we went, I guess, about 70 miles in deep into the ice. And as we were going into the ice, what we expected to see was what we saw, in the Antarctic, that as soon as we headed into the ice that, even though the waters, that were open were relatively productive, we thought, as soon as we head into the ice, it's going to be our biological desert again. Well, so we charged into the ice, and instead of being a biological desert, what we saw was that as we headed in, those numbers, it just kept going up and up and up. The farther we get into the ice,
really?
The higher it got. We started out at the ice edge. It was about 2.5 feet thick of ice.
Mm-hmm.
We got halfway in. It was 3 feet thick of ice. We got in farther. It was about 3.5 feet.
So also the deeper the ice, the more...
The higher it was.
Wow.
And it's like, something's going on here. What is going on here? How can this possibly be? And it was one of those things where if somebody had asked me beforehand, I would have said, there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to find anything under that. The amount of algae in the water under that ice was as high as you would find anywhere in the world. The most productive ocean systems in the world, these values were every bit as high as those. I mean, they were unprecedented. It was, It was really shocking. It was absolutely shocking. The concentrations were so high. And it had all these implications. It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, the first thing is, all right, which is kind of ironic because this is a NASA-funded program. And with NASA, we want to be able to remotely sense what's happening in the ocean. Well, this stuff was happening under the ice. You can't see it from space. So we had no inkling that this stuff is there. We've never had any inkling that this stuff was actually there, that this could have been going on because we can't see it. But what it also means is that at least these parts of the Arctic Ocean are a lot more biologically productive than anybody thought, which has implications for carbon cycling, you know, the amount of atmospheric CO2 that can be taken up by the Arctic Ocean, which has always been assumed to be pretty high, but it's a lot higher than we suspected. You know, in terms of the food web, you know, there's all this food being produced that we had no idea of that's, you know, feeding ecosystems that we're just not very aware of. And so it's all these things that we didn't suspect.
So does it look like this is a result of climate change?
And that's a really big question, because what we do know is that the site that we sampled, where we actually discovered this, if we'd have done it back in 1980, that site would have been covered in probably 8 to 10 feet thick ice.
And it's much older ice too.
Much older ice, and there's no way we could have seen something like this. The only reason we could see it is because the only reason this was there, that these things could grow under the ice, is that the ice is thin now, but it's also got lots of ponds, melt ponds.
Okay.
So as the ice begins to melt, you form these ponds on the top, and these ponds make the ice pretty transparent. So about 50% of the light that is on top of the ice actually makes it through the ice into the water, which doesn't ever happen typically in a normal ice sheet. If we were to go into the Antarctic and do this, you'd be lucky if 1% of the light made it through.
So they can pull energy, they can photosynthesize through the ice ponds.
There's enough light in those ponds that they can photosynthesize. Not only that, things like ultraviolet radiation, for example, which is really harmful for these things, it's completely blocked by the ice. So they're living in this environment where, you know, they've got plenty of light to photosynthesize, but they don't have all the bad stuff that goes along with it. And the growth rates were unheard of. These things were growing faster than any polar organisms of their kind that I've ever seen before. There were rates at first we doubted them. We thought, oh, they can't possibly be growing this fast. We've never seen them growing this fast. And we checked our numbers, and we measured it two different ways, and everything. It was all very consistent. And so it was just a very active, very productive system that we did not expect to see.
So you don't really know what to make of these findings yet.
Not at all, no. Yeah. They're literally hot off the press. You know, one paper's been written. It's not even published yet. And so there's tons of stuff to do. It really raised a lot more questions. Well, it certainly didn't answer any questions because it's something that nobody expected. But there's a lot of follow-up work to do now to figure out the implications, because the implications are so profound, and it's for things not related to even the work I do, because I work typically on phytoplankton, that's what I work on. But you know, the rest of the food web, how is it responding to these kind of events? We have no idea.
Well, at least the most shocking thing you've seen in the Arctic isn't blatantly negative.
That's right.
That's somewhat reassuring. So, going to the polar region is such a rare experience. You've gone into a little bit, but can you tell us maybe a little bit about the more exciting experiences you've had? Any polar bear run-ins or
not close calls for it? I mean, we did see some. I mean, we've seen lots of neat stuff. I mean, there was one time when we were right near the ice edge. This was when we were in the Antarctic, and this was when I was a graduate student. So this is way back when, and we were doing sea ice work. So we were drilling cores through sea ice, and we were doing a transect from pretty far away from the ice edge, right near the ice edge. We got right near the ice edge, and this killer whale just jumped right up out of the water, and it had a huge Antarctic cod in its mouth. I mean, at first we thought we were dead because we thought it was coming after us. And fortunately, it had a mouthful of something, so it wasn't that interested in us. It must have just come up from deep, grabbed it, and continued out of the water.
And it was on the ice?
Well, it didn't. It came up right near the edge of the ice. It didn't actually. We thought it was going to flop onto the ice because that's what it looked like, but it actually just went right back into the water again.
Wow.
So that was a close call.
Do you ever feel like you're in a dangerous situation when you're taking cores on this thin ice?
Not because of that. Well, I mean, the scarier things are the leopard seals in the Antarctic.
Oh, okay.
You worry about those a lot more because they're stealthy. It's hard to miss a killer whale. It's pretty easy to miss a leopard seal. But I was always more worried about falling through a crack in the ice than I was about anything eating me.
Did you ever?
We came close a few times. We had our track vehicles and, there would be a crack that was 3 or 4 feet wide that we'd have to clear with the vehicle because you got to get, once ice starts cracking and moving out, you got to get back to shore. You don't want to ride that ice flow.
So you've done research in these remote places so often. Is it still exciting for you to travel there?
Oh yeah, I mean, it is because
you still look forward to it.
You just never know. I mean, you just never know what you're going to be surprised by. You think you understand a system, you've studied it a long time, and it's great to know. And that's what I tell my students. You just never know what's going to surprise you. I mean, there's so much left to learn, and that's one of the reasons why I like studying polar environments, because they are. Compared to a lot of other places in the world, they're not beautiful tropical places that everybody likes to go. They're the kind of places that not many people really want to go, especially on a ship, and it's rough, and you get seasick. And so it means that there's lots and lots of work to be done. And you just never know what you're going to find. And so every time we go there, it seems like we find something new. So it's, that's going to keep me coming back for the rest of my career, I'm sure.
So it sounds like the sense of excitement that you experience is almost entirely based on the findings that you have there.
Well, that is part of it. It's hard to say it's fun to go. The last two cruises, I was chief scientist. There was a group of 50 scientists, and it was a great group of scientists. It was a great team, but it's a lot of work to keep the crews organized, keep everybody happy, and it's somewhat stressful, and there's not a lot of downtime. There's long hours, and every once in a while, you'll go out on deck and you'll see a whale or something, and it's like, oh yeah, this is great. But lots of times, you're in your room and you're trying to plan for the next set of stations, and it's a lot of it's not as glamorous as people might think an Arctic expedition might be. And so the findings really are an important part of it. It's because, a lot, if you look at day to day, we're doing lots of, I have students who are there who are basically filtering water for 12 hours a day, every day for 35 days. And you think, how in the world do you keep somebody interested in doing that for 12? But what it is what that eventually tells you when you look at the data at the end. That's what keeps you doing it.
Because so you really have to love your research to enjoy a trip out there.
You really do. You absolutely have to, yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to the remote sensing work you said you do.
So basically, there's a suite of satellites that NASA has flying around the Earth. They're orbiting about every 90 minutes or so, and they're about 700 kilometers up.
They orbit the Earth every 90 minutes?
Yeah.
Wow.
They move pretty fast, every 90 minutes. So basically what they're doing is they're monitoring, almost every day, changes that are happening on the Earth's surface. And there's satellites that look at the land, there's satellites that look at the ocean, there's satellites that look at the ice. There's all different kinds. The kinds we are dealing with are the ones that look at the ocean, and particularly the color of the ocean. We want to see how green is it. If it's green, that means it's biologically productive. So those are the things we look for. And it's easier to do that when there's not ice blocking the satellite sensor.
Okay. I know that you're part of a large group that kind of believes that remote sensing is the new big thing for climate research. Can you explain why exactly? How is this new technology affecting climate research?
Well, I think what it allows you to do is it allows you to go and make measurements places where you can't go.
Mm-hmm.
To try to get, we can get in a satellite an image of the Earth, in 2 days we can get almost the entire Earth. To take and send ships and make those same measurements, you couldn't do it. You couldn't afford it. It's no possible way. So what satellites give you is they give you unprecedented resolution in time and resolution in space where it's almost a daunting amount of data you get because you you know, there's Earth is a big place, and you're getting pictures of it every single day, and you're getting pictures of different aspects of it every single day. But it allows you to really, you know, once you have long-term records of these, to sort of build up a picture of how the world is changing. It's very difficult, unless you sample the same place over and over, to document change if you're just doing routine oceanographic sampling. You know, you can't sample here and then sample there, you know, and say anything about whether anything has changed. You've got to repeatedly look at the same place over and over again. And satellites allow you to do that basically everywhere in the world all at once. And you, there's no other way to do it.
So it sounds like you kind of have always been looking for an opportunity to do research in the Arctic or Antarctica.
You know, I wouldn't say it's always been. It's been in for a long time. I remember when I was a grad student, I was laughing at the friends of mine who were going, you know, the one thing I said is I don't want to go someplace cold, and I don't want to work with something that I can't see. And of course, what do? I work with, you know, microscopic phytoplankton in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And, you know, and it's sort of a lesson to grad students. You just never know, because yeah. I didn't know. And the only reason I did was because my major professor, he wasn't my major professor yet, but he said, you know, I got this grant funded. I need a student to come with me down to the Antarctic. And back then I was doing modeling. I was doing ecosystem modeling. And he said, you know, we got 10 years of data on this ecosystem that lives inside the ice in the Antarctic. And would you like to come down, do whatever experiments you need to do to sort of fill out the rest of the model? And, you know, I thought for a while and thought, you know, I sort of bit the bullet and said, yeah, sure, you know, I'll come. And then I just, you know, go there and you fall
in love
with the place.
So you weren't so inspired to go at first.
I wasn't at all. I mean, it's not something that I'd really thought about. I hadn't really thought much about polar research. There was really no exposure as an undergraduate to polar research.
So switching gears a little bit, in many ways the oceans are sort of the most vulnerable part of the climate system, or that's kind of how I've come to see them. And I've heard from other people that it's been largely ignored, or you can just see it, especially with the Copenhagen conference, how it was just largely ignored by legislators. What do you anticipate, what part do you see oceans playing in the environmental movement that's going on?
I think they've been ignored because, well, for one thing, you can't see. I mean, you can see the ocean, but you can't see the effects we have on the ocean. It's really easy to look at a parcel of land and, you know, if we've cut the trees down or we've, you know, turned a forest into a cropland, we know that. In the ocean, it's, you know, our effects are almost invisible and they're below the surface and you can't see them. And the other thing is the ocean is just this vast area that people assume that, you know, we can dump anything we want in there and the ocean is going to just happily absorb it and it's not going to have any effect. And that's not the case. And I think more and more people are becoming to realize that, you know, the ocean is not an infinite, you know, dumping ground for whatever we want to put in it. I still think there's a long way to go, clearly, you know, based on, you know, recent results from some of these, you know, higher level conferences that hasn't really given the ocean its due, I don't think. As more and more information comes in, you know, ocean acidification is suddenly becoming on the radar screen of lots of people. You know, 5-6 years ago, you didn't hear ever about ocean acidification. It just wasn't in anybody's vocabulary. And so I think people are starting to recognize that there's big problems. The other problem, though, is it's, you know, whose jurisdiction is it? You know, it's the ocean, right? You know, who's responsible for it? And which
in that
makes
sense,
it also,
it really does seem like the ultimate dumping ground.
It is. I mean, because you can dump it here and it's going to end up somewhere else and it's somebody else's problem. You don't really have to worry about it necessarily. And makes it so that people really don't want, unless it's a really local effect, people often don't worry about it. And that makes it more challenging, too. So hopefully people will come around.
Now that we're on the darker side of your research, would you say that your work and research has led to you having a more positive or negative outlook on the environment and what's going on right now?
I mean, I don't like to be pessimistic. I mean, it sometimes
you don't seem like a pessimist.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's hard to be optimistic, and I think that's one of the. So I'm probably a little bit, you know, it's a little depressing when you look at how much ice is melting away. You know, the animals that live in the Arctic that have to have ice to live, you know, when I start to think, you know, is there a way to turn this around? And there's no clear path to turning it around other than really hard decisions dealing with atmospheric CO2 concentrations, which are not the same as, you know, changing land use practices or something else where you can have an immediate effect somewhere else. But I'm still pretty upbeat. I mean, you know.
How do you maintain that? Do you see a path materializing eventually?
I really think that people will in the end, do the right thing. I think I hope that it comes before things.
So you have a pretty positive outlook on humanity.
I do. I think generally when you look back in the face of catastrophes, humans usually step up and pitch in and try to fix the problem. I think the issue now is people don't understand the scale of the problem, and there's obviously a political side of that. You know, things are going to have to get worse before they get better, I suspect, before people are really willing to suffer a little bit of pain to fix the problem.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?